Just as the Islamic world was making its peace with the Mongol invasion, the world was hit by the Black Death, which killed anywhere from 30% to 50% of the people in many cities. However, immediately afterwards, a man rose up in Central Asia who wanted to give those numbers a strong challenge. This man is remembered as Tamerlane by the West. This video is part of a collaboration between Al Muqaddimah and What If Alt Hist. After you're done watching this video, don't forget to click the link on the screen or in the description to watch his video. First things first, I'm going to show a lot of restraint in this video because a lot of you comment on how I'm unfairly biased against a man who killed more people than Hitler with a much smaller population. So I won't call him any names that the historians haven't called him by. I will be totally professional and neutral. Let's get started. In the years following the collapse of the Mongol Empire, various successor khanates had emerged. Basically, the empire had been divided amongst the many sons and grandsons of Genghis Khan. We're only concerned with two for now. First, the Ilkhanat, which had been given to Hulagu Khan, the grandson of Genghis Khan. Although over the next century, it had converted to Islam and fallen apart. Its former territory of Persia, Iraq, and Syria had fallen to local powers. To the east, there was the Chagatai Khanat. By Timur's time, it was essentially divided in two. The east of Tian Shan range was Mughalistan. Mughal is Persian for Mongol and Stan means the land of, while the west of the range was Transoxiana, also known as Mavran Nahar. Timur was born in 1336 CE, near what is today Shahrisabz in Uzbekistan, to a minor noble of the Barlas clan. The Barlas shared ancestry with Genghis Khan himself, although they weren't his descendants. There were Mongols who had moved to Khorasan and had adopted many Turkic traditions which had pretty much Turkified them. We don't know much about his childhood, but he became somewhat prominent around the year 1360 at the age of 24 or so. The Emir of the Western Chagatai Khanate was assassinated, and taking advantage of that, the Khan of the Eastern Chagatai Khanate, also known as the Mughal Khan, had invaded. The head of the Barlas clan was a man named Haji Beg. He decided to flee with his tribe, fearing the invasion, but Timur promised him to win his homeland back if he gave him some men. Timur took those men and marched to the Khan's camp, where he did what's called a pro-gamer move and switched sides. He swore allegiance to the Khan and became his subject. He was then installed as the chief of the Barlas tribe, although the Khan decided to install his own son as the governor of Transoxiana. Timur was not happy with that and decided to revolt, along with an aristocrat named Hussein. Hussein's family had ruled the region prior to the invasion of the Khan. Timur solidified the alliance by marrying Hussein's sister. Over the next few years, as the Mughal Khan invaded Transoxiana, Timur and his men became something like highway bandits. They harassed the army of the Khan and on occasion suffered major defeats. At one point, it's said that his entourage came down to just him, his wife, and one more. It was probably at this point that Timur received the injury that led to his unfortunate and much hated nickname. It was around 1363 CE. Along with the injury on his right leg that made him lame for the rest of his life, he lost his little finger and his ring finger. It's said that he was left for the dead in that battle and managed to crawl to safety and eventually glory. In the somewhat legendary final battle with the Khan's army, Timur had his men burn campfires all over the area to give the impression of a larger army. Similarly, when he charged, he ordered his men to tie leafy branches on their horses so that they would stir up more dust than they would otherwise. This was effective and scared the enemy into giving chase. Through guerrilla tactics and psychological warfare, Timur defeated the Khan's army. As one writer said, he triumphed over an army by fire and conquered a city by dust. The city he had conquered, Shahrisabz, became his base and he glorified it with many architectural projects, some of which still stand today. While Timur was the brilliant commander, he lacked legitimacy to actually rule, especially in this Turco-Mongol environment where kin were everything. His humble genealogy did not do him any favors. Hussein, being of much higher birth, was the more senior of the two, at least in terms of titles, although Hussein fell out of favor soon after. The Khan invaded Transoxiana again in 1365 CE. This time, like before, he was stopped by Timur and Hussein. Although in this battle, Hussein had been reluctant and unreliable for Timur. The next year, they invaded Samarkand together. Hussein started styling himself as sort of the Khan of Transoxiana, even though his official title was of Emir. Timur was patient and building alliances that would allow him to rise up. Luckily for him, the glue that was holding the alliance together, Timur's wife and Hussein's sister passed away in 1366 CE. The relationship between the two fell further into decay. It came to a head in 1370 when Timur invaded Balkh, Hussein's capital. Hussein was killed in the aftermath by one of Timur's subordinates. He took Hussein's wife, Sare Mulk Khanum, as his own wife. She was a princess and a descendant of Genghis Khan himself. Through her, Timur got a bit of that legitimacy he so dearly wanted. He styled himself Timur Gurgan from there on, meaning the son-in-law of the great Khan. Since he could not rule himself, he installed a puppet Khan of Transoxiana while he became the actual ruler and took the rather humble title of Amir. Hence, he is known as Amir Timur in the Muslim world today. Next, Timur set his eyes on Khwarizm. It was an oasis and an important part of the Silk Road. It was a rich, independent region that, if conquered, would greatly enrich Timur's realm. Timur wrote to its ruler, asking for submission, but his famous reply was that Khwarizm had been granted its independence by the sword, and only the sword can take it away. And, as it turns out, Timur had plenty of swords. He invaded Khwarizm in 1372 CE. The city of Kath fell, and it was to be a trailer for what was to come for any city that tried to resist the great conqueror. Timur killed all men and threw women and children into slavery. While not all of Khwarizm was conquered yet, Timur reached an agreement with his ruling family, and in exchange for some key cities and a royal princess for his son Jahangir, he retreated. Although that marriage didn't last long, as Jahangir died in 1376 CE. At the age of only 20, Timur mourned his death for months. This halted his conquests for a while, although he demonstrated his political brilliance once again when he installed a pretender to the throne of the White Horde to the north to increase instability in the region. This was so the White Horde and the Golden Horde would fight each other instead of attacking him. The pretender was Tokhtamish, who would become important later. Soon after, there was a rebellion by the ruler of Khwarizm, who had sworn loyalty to Timur previously. Timur attacked his capital at Urganj. Here, he was challenged by the ruler to one-on-one combat, and interestingly, Timur, who was lame in his right leg, still accepted it. Although when he went to the city gates, alone and unprotected, the ruler got scared, sick, and then died. The revolt was quashed and, as always, Urganj, the city of plenty, was sacked. In 1379 CE, Timur wrote a letter to the ruler of Herat, a man whose father Timur had once served. Timur asked for submission, and when rejected, he attacked Herat in 1381 CE. The people of Herat, scared of the sacks Timur had committed before, surrendered. Herat and its immense wealth were now Timur's. The Qartid dynasty, which had ruled Herat, accepted Timur's overlordship. This event made Timur realize what his reputation could actually do. Herat was basically the most prosperous city in the region, and if he could win it without having to shed a drop of blood, what more could he do? He started his campaign into Persia. Over the next 9 years, he conquered a large portion of Persia. Around the same time, the city of Isfizar in Khorasan revolted. It was subdued, and the rebels were cemented into the walls alive to keep a physical monument reminding Khorasan of what comes to those who resist. During his conquest of Sistan, his horse was killed with an arrow from underneath him. He vowed revenge, and when the capital, Zaranj, sued for peace, he told them to surrender all weapons. Once they did, he went on to massacre everyone in the city. The granary of East Sistan was reclaimed by desert and ruin. He went as far as Sultania in that campaign. He had eyes for Tabriz, but decided to return to Samarkand instead. At this point, Timur's old friend, Tokhtamish, sacked Tabriz. Timur took this as an insult of the highest degree. Timur had put Tokhtamish on the throne of the White Horde himself, although now he had become the Khan of the Golden Horde and had merged them both. Timur decided that his action demands a reaction, lest he appear weak. Funny enough, since Tokhtamish was not a Muslim, Timur's chroniclers claim that Timur considered it a crime against Islam and himself the protector of Islam. He marched west again and took Tabriz. Its elites had abandoned it, and the people sued for peace. They were spared. Instead of moving further west, he moved north, toward Georgia. Georgia was a Christian island in the Sea of Islam, and, well, the self-proclaimed protector of Islam now had to change that. Georgian capital of Tbilisi was vigorously defended, but it was taken. The king, Bagrat the Great, was captured and was offered to convert to Islam in exchange for his life. The king did, and he was reinstated as a vassal king. That same winter, lands north of Georgia were attacked by the Golden Horde. Timur engaged them and took some prisoners and freed them with a message to remind Tokhtamish of his treaty. Timur then swept across western Persia and Kurdistan. Isfahan was taken without bloodshed, but it was later sacked when it attempted to revolt. Shiraz was taken as well. The Muzaffarid ruler, Shah Shuja, had died in 1384 CE and actually left his realm to Timur in a letter. Basically, he divided his realm amongst his sons and nephews and accepted Timur as his overlord, although his son, Zainul Abidin, refused to accept Timur's power. However, Timur received even more shocking news from home. Transoxiana, the heart of the empire, was under attack by Tokhtamish. His eldest living son, Prince Umar Sheikh, had barely escaped with his life. Tokhtamish was not any rival monarch. He had been given refuge by Timur, who had taken him as his protege. Tokhtamish knew all of Timur's tactics and deployed them against Timur during the upcoming war. Timur, it seems, had admiration for him as well. He had Timur's ability of raising an army with great speed and loyalty. Over the next 5 years, Timur engaged in skirmishes with the Golden Horde and local rebellions till 1390 CE. The path was cleared. Timur's army was loyal to him because he was always able to provide them loot. Timur realized that a defensive war was not very profitable for the men and instead decided to go on the offensive. Timur marched his 200,000 strong army north without consideration of the season. His army shivered in the cold, but the Golden Khan had to be found and defeated. In summer 1391 CE, at Kundurcha River, he defeated the Golden Horde, although Tokhtamish escaped. Timur returned to Samarkand and marched west once again to bring back Persia, Kurdistan, and Georgia into his fold. He swept across his empire, conquering cities, including Baghdad, and massacring people. However, Tokhtamish was back with an army. This time as well, Timur chased his army until he found it on the banks of the Terek River in modern-day Chechnya in 1395 CE. Tokhtamish lost and ran again. Timur was determined to find him and bring an end to this conflict once and for all. But when he couldn't find the Khan, he burned the Khanate. Various cities were sacked and populations were massacred to destabilize the Golden Horde. Massive loot was taken, and not only that, but destroying key cities, he was able to put the Northern Silk Road route into disuse. The Silk Road trade was now forced to flow through his empire. The next 2 years, 1396 and 1397, Timur spent in peace, beautifying the only city that he ever cared for, Samarkand, the Rome of the East. In 1398 CE, the barbarian Amir decided to attack the Golden Sparrow itself, the prosperous city of Delhi. There were two reasons for that. First, it was ruled by the Tughlaq and was practically inviting foreign invasion as it had been weakened by infighting and terrible governance. Secondly, great conquerors like Alexander and Genghis Khan had failed to take India. Timur wanted to do what no one else had been able to do. Timur started his march in the month of March in 1398 CE. He fought some tribes in the Hindu Kush mountains and arrived in Kabul. He dispatched his grandson, Pir Muhammad, to attack Multan in southern Punjab, modern-day Pakistan. Pir Muhammad took it after a six-month siege, which saw the natives so deprived of food that they ate their dead. The city of saints was put to the sword. Pir Muhammad then met with Timur, who was sweeping across Punjab. Cities like Bakhpatan and Dipalpur were sacked. Their population was slaughtered. Thousands were taken as prisoners. When Timur arrived outside Delhi, he found it protected by 10,000 horsemen, 20 to 40,000 infantry, and 120 elephants. To scare the people of Delhi, he slaughtered all the Hindustani prisoners he had taken across his march right before their eyes. Even the holy men were forced to execute people. On 17th of December 1398 CE, the two armies met. The biggest threat were the elephants, and Timur had a plan for them. He had camels bearing bundles of dried grass, which enticed the elephants to follow them. The camels panicked and ran, and the elephants tried to chase them, trampling the soldiers of Delhi around them until they ran into traps of caltrops placed by Timur's men, which impaled and killed the elephants. Delhi was taken. Timur stayed outside Delhi for 2 weeks while his men looted the city. It seems some locals had gotten into a fight with the invading army, which resulted in a sack of the city. The city's inhabitants were killed in huge numbers. Rest were taken prisoner. Even the poorest soldiers seized 20 prisoners. The Hindu inhabitants, who outnumbered the invaders 10 to 1, burned their homes, wives, and children and attacked the barbarians in a frenzy. Although it was of no use, Delhi, the city of gems and perfumes, was reduced to rubble. He attacked some other places in India like Meerut and Kashmir. He collected unimaginable plunder, including the surviving elephants, from the Golden Sparrow that was Hindustan. Around 4 months after he arrived in Samarkand, he left for another campaign in 1399 CE. This campaign, often called the Pilgrimage of Destruction, would see hundreds of thousands dead and around a dozen cities sacked by the end. Prince Miran Shah, who ruled over Persia, had fallen into his decadent ways. He had let his extravagant drinking get in the way of administration, and that was unacceptable. Timur, it seems, was concerned that he might even revolt. It would be a descendant of Mihran Shah Babur who would invade India again in 1526 CE and establish the Mughal dynasty. Mihran Shah was deposed and joined his father's retinue in the campaign west. Timur attacked Georgia again, and when it was subdued, people were given the choice to find their faith in Allah and the Prophet Muhammad or find themselves at the end of a sword. At this point, tensions were building between Timur and two other rulers in the Muslim world. Sultan Bayezid Yıldırım of the Ottoman Empire had given refuge to a rebellious rival of Timur, and heated letters had been exchanged between Timur and Bayezid. In August of 1400 CE, Timur laid siege to Sivas, an Ottoman city which surrendered. Again, massacres were conducted and the city was sacked. Bayezid could not respond in time. Timur, thinking of it as a warning for the Ottomans, moved south into Syria. Syria was under the control of the Mamluks of Egypt at the time. Mamluks similarly had given refuge to someone Timur wanted dead. They had also killed his ambassadors. Timur was not going to take that lightly. On top of everything, Barkok, the Mamluk Sultan, had passed away in 1399 CE. The Sultanate was still recovering under his son Nasir ad-Din Furj, who was just a boy at the time, no older than 16. Timur swept across Greater Syria and sacked cities such as Antioch, Acre, Baalbek, Beirut, Hama, Homs, Aleppo, and Damascus. The sack of Damascus is especially noteworthy because Furj had brought an army which was in a better state than that of Timur. Timur's army was exhausted already from the Indian campaign and had hardly had any time to rest. The Mamluks, on the other hand, were battle-ready. Although when the armies faced each other, Furj decided to turn back. He was afraid of an uprising in Cairo and left Damascus to the hands of the barbarian emperor. The army had brought one interesting guest along, a man named Ibn Khaldun. Ibn Khaldun was sent to Timur to negotiate with him. He stayed with Timur for 7 weeks. Once this channel is big enough, you can be sure I'll produce a Netflix miniseries based on this meeting. Timur was impressed by Ibn Khaldun and allowed him to leave Damascus alive. Damascus was then sacked. Thousands of Muslims were killed. Its grand Umayyad mosque was destroyed and the city was burned. Timur would later claim that he had done so to avenge the death of the Alids by the Umayyads. This statement and its hypocrisy are exactly why my lifelong dream is to go and pee on Timur's grave someday. Then the self-proclaimed protector of Islam sacked Baghdad, which was still recovering from the Mongol sack in 1258 CE. Okay, moving on. Timur then headed northwest into Anatolia to face Bayezid. Bayezid's army was in poor condition already, and Timur, through his brilliant strategy, managed to outmaneuver them and attack Ankara, where the two armies met on 28th of July 1402 CE. The Ottomans were defeated and Bayezid himself was captured. The great Sultan, who had made Eastern Europe tremble with his mere mention, was taken and put in a cage. The thunderbolt had struck for the last time. Ottoman Empire was divided and almost ended, but the sun would shine on the house of Osman once again. Timur also took Smyrna from the Knights of Rhodes, again conducting a massacre. Timur, as he had now defeated Christians, labeled himself Ghazi from there on. Having painted the map of the Muslim world with blood, he now sought another prize. This time to the east, he now wanted the Ming Empire. After resting for a short while in Samarkand, the emperor found death close and wanted to outdo himself before he died. After all, a lot of people who had fought alongside him had died. Not only that, two of his sons had died. And in 1403 CE, Muhammad Sultan Mirza, his beloved grandson and designated heir, had died as well. Timur divided his empire among his sons and grandsons and collected an army to march on China. He usually started his campaigns in spring, but this time he couldn't wait and went in the winter. Around 160 kilometers east of Samarkand, the great conqueror caught a fever and closed his eyes for the last time. In the end, I'm going to let a brother of mine, who is connected to me beyond centuries through a mutual hatred of Timur, Ibn Arab Shah, speak about Timur as he does in the last chapter of his book. He had seen the sack of Damascus with his own eyes and was brutally critical of Timur, as he writes in his biography. Timur was tall and lofty of stature, as though he belonged to the remnants of the Amalekites, wonderful in nature, white in color, mixed with red but not dark, stout of limb, with broad shoulders, lame on the right side. He did not fear death, and though he was near his 70th year, yet he was firm in mind, strong and robust in body, brave and fearless, like a hard rock. He did not care for jesting or lying. Wit and trifling pleased him not. Truth, even if it was painful, delighted him. He was not sad in adversity or joyful in prosperity. He did not allow in his company any obscene talk, or talk of bloodshed, rapine, plunder, and violation of the harem. He was spirited and brave and inspired awe and obedience. He loved bold and valiant soldiers, by whose aid he opened the locks of terror, tore men to pieces like lions, and through them and their battles overturned mountains. Timur loved learned men and admitted to his inner reception nobles of the family of Muhammad. He gave the highest honor to the learned and doctors and preferred them to all others and received each of them according to his rank and granted them honor and respect. He used towards them familiarity and an abatement of his majesty. In his arguments with them, he mingled moderation with splendor, clemency with rigor, and covered his severity with kindness. There were also in his army many women who mingled in the melee of battle and in fierce conflicts, and strove with men and fought with brave warriors, and overcame mighty heroes in combat with the thrust of the spear, the blow of the sword, and shooting of the arrows. When one of them was heavy with child, and birth pangs seized her while they were on the march, she turned from the way and, withdrawing apart and descending from her beast, gave birth to the child and, wrapping it in bandages, soon mounted her beast and, taking the child with her, followed her company. And there were in his army men born on the march and grown to full age who married and begot children and yet never had a fixed home. He was called the unconquered lord of the seven climes and ruler by land and sea and conqueror of kings and sultans. He clung to the laws of Genghis Khan, on whom be the curse of Allah. Timur must be accounted an infidel and those also who prefer the laws of Genghis Khan to the faith of Islam. From the statement by Ibn Arab Shah, it seems Timur was full of duality. Which he was. He respected and adhered to Mongol traditions. He also prayed to Allah before a battle in full view of his army. He allowed and ordered his men to pillage, murder, and rape, but he didn't like for these subjects to be mentioned in his presence. All the men who served under him considered him kind, but those who were innocent victims of his bloodshed would definitely not use that word. He called himself the protector of Islam, but most of the blood that was spilled under his command was that of Muslims. He didn't respect any cities, no matter how culturally and geographically important, except Samarkand. He built a great empire, but as soon as he died, his sons and grandsons picked up the sword, and within 50 years of his death, the empire was pretty much gone. He secured loyalty of his men with loot from his campaigns, and the first thing he thought about was loot. That's why he never fought a defensive battle. Timur was vilified by the Soviet Union, but after their collapse, he has now emerged as a cultural and nationalistic icon in Uzbekistan. His descendants would go on to embrace the land that he himself had so savagely destroyed. Babur would lay the foundation of the Mughal dynasty in India 120 years later.
Now, what if Timur was never born? That would be a great world, but it would be very different. To learn more about that beautiful, beautiful world, check out What If Alt Hist's video. Links on the screen and in the description right now.
See you next time.